Hi, we are super happy to be here again. We were already here last weekend. I'm very excited to be here in this university, which is the first time I've been here in Sweden. We are going to talk, of course, about this project, this Biennale that we co-curated in Istanbul in 2016, and the ideas actually that we have preparing and during this Biennale that we all put together in this little book, the archaeology, Are We Human? The Notes on an Archaeology of Design. And our main point is that everything is design from the moment you wake up in the morning to basically to the whole planet. So this is important to us because, of course, design biennales, unlike let's say our biennales, don't have such big questions like are we human, right? People expect of a design biennale that you will come up with the new design for a chair or a nice lamp or something like that, but you will not ask questions about our humanity. And we wanted to claim the capacity that art has always taken for, well, or not always, but from a certain point in history, taking from the answer for itself, the capacity to ask questions, to somehow claim that for architecture and design as well. Right? So it's a big...
So we thought of the whole project as a kind of mirror. I don't know about you, but it's not very pleasant looking into the mirror. I mean, there is this creature you see every time, and after a while you have got used to the idea that it's you, but it's never clear what that you is, and then you have to make some decisions how to make sure the you that you see in the mirror doesn't look as bad as it does when you see it, and then you carry it with you. I mean, it's not necessarily... pleasant, or at least you ask yourself the question, what is that? And you feel like maybe there are two people in the room and you're not sure which one is looking at this sort of situation. All those images you saw before, we regard as a kind of portrait, a sort of very basic portrait of the current sort of situation of the human. So you were yourselves looking into this mirror before. We thought that if everything is designed today, then the most interesting thing, the most radically designed thing in the exhibition would be the visitor. So in a certain sense, the trick was how to make an exhibition in which the visitor would feel somehow kind of exposed. And that's why we assembled all those images as a kind of basic portrait. And this is the portrait that we gave to artists and philosophers and designers and so on to as a kind of a starting point. We researched the question for over a year. We worked with teams at Columbia and Princeton sort of digging into this question, what is design? And after a while, the question morphed from what is design into what is human? Are we human? And then we came up with a set of propositions, eight propositions. And then we simply gave these propositions, this set of eight, to all of the people that we invited. And so we then, as it were, helped them to exhibit their response. So we... The only thing we did in the show was make this set of 8 points. That was it. And then they did the work.
Okay. So if we start with our starting point, the design is always the design of the human. Design always presents itself as serving the human. Yeah, here I am doing a chair for you or a lamp for you. But the point is that... that we were trying to make is that the real ambition of design is to redesign the human. I'm going to give this with an example. These are actually footprints of Neolithic inhabitants of what is now called Istanbul. 8,500 years ago, they were discovered when digging for the new subway. It's kind of a funny story, too, about Erdogan. Because he was upset that the subway work, the metro work, has been interrupted because they have found these Neolithic remains. And he said, but don't they care about the humans? So the whole thing happened during the middle of our Biennale. But the point here for us is that you can see that there is a smooth outline to this imprint. So it's actually the imprint of a zoo, not of a food. So it is already the imprint of human technology. Everybody understands that zoos transform the capacity, behavior, and even the skeleton of the human. The human was redesigned by the zoo. It can be seen in many studies, which actually demonstrates how different bones start to evolve when we start wearing shoes. Rudowski, the famous Austrian architect and designer who emigrated to the United States, in the 1940s criticized the typical Western men's shoe. He also criticized, of course, men's women's shoes, but the men's is more interesting because, I mean, he had this idea that this was completely crazy, and that if we kept going that way with this kind of shoe, we will end up developing a new foot with the big toe in the middle. And here is the footprint of Neil Armstrong on the moon, made possible, of course, by a massive technological apparatus. Only humans could make themselves a shoe and then send themselves up to the moon. So this is the point, that design is what makes us rather than the other way around, even our skeleton is transformed by our actions.
So we live in a time in which absolutely everything is designed. There's been a kind of exponential expansion of design across the planet, into space, and into the body, and into the brain. Actually, that makes it weird for schools like this, because when you teach design, what is it that you're teaching when everything is already designed? Of course, the designs that mark human life are not just the artifacts that you would collect in museums, but they are like patterns of information flow. They're like the collapse of biodiversity. You could consider the loss of biodiversity as something that has been designed. Agriculture, shipping, communication, the planet, space junk. This would be the first thing that you would, first sign of the human that you would encounter if you were coming from Mars. I mean, I have friends that for sure came from Mars, and you would, they would bump into this, right? Space junk, and they're not going to say, "Oh, interesting, this is a piece of technology, let me go and find the species that produced this." The moment they hit this, they say, "Okay, species," right? And then if they would land on Earth, they wouldn't find these fleshy creatures with the legs and say, "Ah, there's the source." I mean, they might go into the genetic code of us, but they would see the whole thing as a kind of interlocking cloud. But this is design, right? So design is even much bigger than the planet, much bigger. Satellites. This is a little satellite that maybe half of you in the room will have eventually, a little valve in your heart. So a kind of internal satellite floating. So you are surrounded by design, but also design is inside you. This might be one of the most spectacular achievements of the human species. This is the ozone hole, beautiful big circle. And we have worked hard to produce this, right? And we are incredibly proud. Notice that when people complain about the disaster of the world that we live in, they do so with a certain pride, like, we have brought ourselves to the edge of, you know, like, it's like there's some kind of strange pride that we have produced this kind of situation. This is design.
Yes. I mean, in fact, the human might even be the species to have systematically designed its own extinction, along with that of countless other species, like this poor bird that have eaten so much plastic. So it's not only that we have caused so many animals to go extinct, but we have systematically designed our own extinction. The Biennale, in that sense, try to reboot the conversation by rethinking the intimate relationship between design and the human, by asking ourselves the question, are we human?
And the project just keeps going. It's a kind of a virus. You know, we did events at Princeton. We hate catalogs. So we thought, you know, let's collaborate with some friends and produce the Superhumanity Project with Eflux. All the writers, we started off with 50 writers, then there was another conference in Princeton and another one and another book in Seoul and Korea, and keeps going and going. We did events in New York and Havana and Seoul and Princeton and Madrid, and all of this just because we feel if you just if you just start to think about design, you need to do this kind of work, and you need to do it with this many people and this many places, just to begin to ask the question.
Right. So today we thought that we will connect, we will try to communicate with you about this little book, the little yellow book that Mark and I wrote in this moment of preparing this. It was kind of a madness situation. If it's not complicated enough to prepare a biennale, in the middle of it, we decided to also write a book in addition to having to do the catalog. But we really thought that it was very important to undermine the idea of the traditional catalog with these essays by the curator that try to explicate the work of the artists and the designers and architects in the exhibition. So we reserved the catalog for the work of the people presented in the exhibition, the artists, the designers, to explain their work or to write about their work in their own words. And then we put everything we were thinking in this other book. So this is the idea of the little book. So yeah. And also we hated also the idea that the Biennale is also finished. So this is why this other collaboration. So the project kept going with the Superhumanity, which was a project with IFLAX Architecture, Nicholas Hiss and Nick Axel. Axel.
Anton
Bridocle, right? Yeah. Where people were writing about the Biennale or issues related to the Biennale, and we put them online, and eventually we put the book with all the contributions in this Superhumanity book. Then there was another conference on Cosmismo, and then we went to Seoul, and then the whole thing keeps, and to Madrid, yeah. And the whole thing keeps going.
I mean, the basic idea is we hate Biennales. So, when you're doing one and you hate them, it's complicated. And the thing we hate the most are curators. So if you're the curator, so we just thought we should put all of our own shit into a separate book and enable mm-hmm, people mm-hmm. to make an encounter with the Biennale without encountering us. Mm-hmm. Right? So this is what it is. Mm-hmm. It's super small, but it's really highly concentrated chemicals. Mm-hmm. It's not a kind of design guide. Like if you want to learn how to design, don't touch this book. It's not a do-it-yourself humanity manual. Mm. Like you read this and feel like thoughtful about humanity. By the way, do-it-yourself humanity manuals, that's like, 70% of bookstores today. Mm. Right? Mm. And maybe the other 30% are do-it-yourself design guides. That's it. It's done. Mm. Right? So bookstores are all full of how to design yourself and your life and your friends in the most perfect cocktail, or how to reflect upon the situation of humanity. This is not neither of those. There's no reason to think that this book would change you, but you're not going to read it and, become a Zen goddess. It's just not going to happen. It's basically a set of archaeological notes, a kind of field notes. We took this archaeological approach. We thought actually the way to think about design, which is always thought of as going to the future, is actually to think of the past. Mm-hmm. We just tried to consider the role of design in defining the human animal from hundreds of thousands of years ago until the last few seconds, something like this.
And what we are going to do now is to give you a little bit of a taste of what this book is about by going back 200,000 years with the question of the human is the designing animal, which Mark will present and will go to more contemporary times, to actually the 20th century, with the idea of an aesthetic design. So those are the two questions that will... So you start with the plastic.
But maybe we could make one kind of... the whole thing is a sort of... I don't know why you're here, actually. but now that you're here, we'll tell you. If, as Beatrice was saying before, if design would be a question mark... Right, and if the human is a question mark, what if the human is endlessly a question? We're the only species that says, "What am I? What am I?" Then maybe design is the way we engage with that question. So design is a kind of way of questioning our own status. If that's the case, then an archaeology of design would be an archaeology of curiosity, like ways that we ask questions of ourselves as a species. So it's not simply about the history of the human animal as revealed in all the layers of artifacts. So it's not like a history of how we evolved according to what we have designed. It's really a history of different ways in which the human has reinvented itself. It's about how the human has done this astonishing thing of redesigning itself again and again and again and again.
Okay, so you start with the plastic and keep an eye on the time.
Yep. Out. So we're going to split, and we're going to split in time, like Beatrice says. I'm going to go back hundreds of thousands of years, and she's going to go back like 2 seconds. And with the theme of the plastic human, I don't know, it's a sort of amputated hand, but but really it's a kind of normal hand. Or to say it another way around, how weird is a normal hand? Have you ever looked at your hand? I mean, actually, a lot of people do. If you look in the subway, you see people just... It's odd. Right? It's not as odd as the ear. Think about the ear. It's the weirdest thing, the single weirdest part of the human body. More different, by the way, than fingerprints. Right? In theory, it's a technological device, right, to help you. So in theory, there would be some sort of geometry which nature would have figured out was perfect. But look at our ears. Totally weird. Right? And this maybe is the beginning of the issue. And I just read you from the book. I know in general, English men are boring. I think this is a relatively stable scientific fact. But I offer you a couple of exceptions here and try to explain it. What are we trying to say? That the human is an unstable category. It's not like where you begin from, what would the human design? It's really like a question. Even an unstable being. We are not a clearly defined biological organism with a particular set of capacities that collaborates with social networks and objects around it to change things. On the contrary, whatever the human is, it's defined by its diversity and plasticity, its ability to modify its own abilities. And it is this very plasticity, the radical instability of the human, that is the basis of its massive impact. The more malleable and more indeterminate, the more plastic the human is, the more extreme its impact. In redesigning itself, it redesigns the planet. But equally and simultaneously, the redesigned world redesigns the designing animal. This is the real plasticity that's human, our ability to be changed and to change. What makes the human human, therefore, is not inside the body or the brain, or even inside the collective social body, but in our independency, our weird, strange independency with artifacts. The human is somehow suspended in a complex and continuous back and forth between itself and artifacts, a flickering that ultimately dissolves the distinction between them. Designed artifacts have as much agency as the animal that seemingly produced them. They transform the animal just as much as they are transformed by the animal. Or to say it the other way around, the body and the brain are artifacts. I mean, from the beginning, they are not the producers of artifacts, but are artifacts in their own right. What is human is precisely the radicality of this mutual exchange. In other words, artifacts are never simply the representation of human intentions and abilities. They are also somehow openings, possibilities of something new in the human, even a new human. Artifacts are part of the body and the brain. They are thoughts, but equally they are the potential of new ways of thinking. So following that line of thought, the archaeology of design is not a kind of self-gratulatory linear narrative about the steady evolution of a singular creature progressively adapting itself to the world with ever more sophisticated capacities and technologies and adapting to its own adaptions. Rather, it's simply the history of a question mark. Am I human? Right? Am I a human? So finally, getting back to the two English guys, May 26 and June 2nd of 1859, the geologist Joseph Prestwich and the archaeologist John Evans gave matching papers to the scientific elite at the Royal Society and the Society of Antiquities in London, so the two most sort of august scientific bodies. The geologist and the archaeologist argued that some teardrop-shaped stone objects, like this one, that had been found alongside the bones of long extinct mammals in digs in France and England, exhibited the uniquely human intelligence of design. So just to quote the lecture, they said, there is, of this object, a uniformity of shape, a correctness of outline, and a sharpness about the cutting edges and points which cannot be due to anything other than design. So basically they're saying that because you can see design there, then this must have been produced by humans, And since it was found alongside bones of mammals thought to be extinct long, long before the human arrived, then actually the human must be much, much older than was thought possible. These objects, produced by what Prestwich evocatively called blows applied by design. So it's not like you bang on an object and then it gets into a certain shape. Actually, the design is the banging, is blows of design. They were found alongside these ancient organisms, and Prestwich insisted that his argument did not depend on the evidence of skill. So it was not like how well-crafted this object is, but on the evidence of design. In other words, he was arguing that they were not just made, they were thought. The person who wanted this to make this object sort of thought that object into existence. The archaeologists, they held these objects in the lecture. They're very heavy, by the way, so they're holding them like this. They measured them, they drew them, they felt the weight of this object, and they felt the way the object was transforming their body when holding it. They imagined themselves as primitive humans, holding these objects with this new kind of capacities, as if imagining the birth of humanity in the birth of technology. Again, just looking at some of their drawings of these objects. Without ever having to say it, their reading of this object depended on the idea that the human is a designer. So you find design, then you found the human. It was just 6 months later that Charles Darwin published On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, a truly radical and shocking book that embraced the idea that humans were ancient, but more radically rejected the idea that any organism, including the human, had been designed by some kind of divine intelligence. Darwin scandalously argued that the sort of relentlessly impressive appearance of a unity of design throughout the organic world is actually a product of the essential mutability of all species. He used this example of the eye. By the way, this is the example everybody arguing about design in the natural world used. The eye is supposed to be so spectacularly complex that only design could have produced it. And he said, actually, clearly defined organisms with very precise functions are paradoxically the product of extreme malleability. The human eye is the product of millions of minute variations in millions of minute elements over millions of years. So actually, natural selection is design without a designer. So his argument, as you know, is famously against design, but the lack of design is what produces design precisely. Like if somebody sat down and tried to do this, they would screw it up, right? Now, this sort of double revolution, on the one hand, finding these ancient objects that suggest that the human was much older than religion would have agreed to before, and on the other hand, finding out that the human was not so different from any other species and was part of an overall evolutionary process, dramatically transformed thinking about mentality, biology, and technology. Actually, by the way, Darwin financially supported some of the archaeological digs of Prestwich and Evans. At first, he didn't believe it. At first, he said, like, it's ridiculous, this idea, because they were finding so many of these objects. He said, if humans really did produce these, then humans would have done basically nothing other than make these, just sat there all day. And actually, by the way, that is the current theory, that the dominant activity was to produce these objects, most of which show no signs of ever being used. So producing these useless objects that look useful, something like this. He started to speculate that using such stone tools would have affected the evolution of the shape of the human hands. In other words, if I have a tool that enables me to do something in the world, and the more I do that in the world, the more I have an ability to use that tool, the more I have a skeleton shaped to use that tool, then the tool will actually affect the shape of my body. This theory was only proven 4 years ago with the discovery of this skeleton of Homo naledi. But what's amazing about this skeleton is that this hand shows evidence of being very good for hanging from trees and very good for throwing things. It's right in the intersection between one state and the other. So in other words, the inherited structure of the body is ultimately altered by its technological extensions. It's not just that we would use technology, we would be, just by virtue of that, a different kind of species, a different kind of body. For all of his opposition to the idea of a designer of nature, according to his own argument, the human can actually change the shape of its own organism over countless generations. In other words, most obviously, we are redesigned gradually by our tools. Now, this super shocking encounter with prehistoric humanity and the blurring of any line between the human and the animal coincided, of course, with the equally shocking encounter with extreme industrialization in the mid-19th century. So this is exactly the moment that people are feeling dehumanized by being treated as machines in order to serve machines which are being treated like organisms. So I can run a factory only to the extent that I can make my body move like a machine and feed the machine, which is now understood to be a sort of thirsty organism. So this potential reversal, this kind of humanization of technology and this kind of turning technological of the human, this was being discussed not just in philosophical circles, but in the newspapers. It was a major issue. And all of the stuff going on with Darwin is right in the middle of that kind of equation. The kind of crucial point, I suppose, in this argument, it's not that there was a kind of conceptual and biological theory of evolution being developed that then could be applied to the question of design. It was not that the concepts of design rested on these kind of biological concepts. It's almost the other way around. For example, and by the way, this is the little bone. It's kind of crucial. You see it has a little lump on the top there. That bone, if you found it in your hand, would be like this position in your hand. The evidence of that particular bone, just resting like this, very, very small, it's 1.4 million years old. It's a finger bone, which was found in 2013. Very, very close to the oldest tools that have been discovered, is the first piece of evidence for the evolution of the human body in relationship to technology, some 600,000 years earlier than was previously thought. So just 4 or 5 years ago, we reverse engineered the emergence of the human species by 600,000 years as a result of finding this bone. The more this archaeological work does, the more the supposedly human species goes back further and further in time, such that you have these kinds of combination, this kind of evolution of the body. And it's, again, getting back to these stone tools, it turned out to be super embarrassing because actually the very first such tool to have been discovered was this one, which was found in 1800 by a guy called John Frere, who simply dug a hole and found it. And he thought, this is so amazing. And he found alongside mammoth bones. And he said, okay, obviously the human lived much longer. He headed off to the Royal Society, made a presentation, did these incredible drawings, and said, obviously the human is much older than we thought, and drew it and published it, and it was published in the Royal Society. And it was such a scandalous, such an impossible argument, nobody noticed. Super embarrassing. And the moment in which finally, and you see just the precision with which he drew this object, the moment in which suddenly the argument came to a head was with the taking of this photograph. And it's not by accident, because if I can take a photograph of finding one of these stones, then I have a kind of forensic evidence, and you can see a worker is pointing to a piece of stone sticking out, and the whole point is that the fat end of this thing is in the ground and the thin end is out, so it can't have been just planted by the workers. And those two English, Prestwich and Evans, are watching as this photograph is being taken in the south of France on April 27 of 1859, and this is what came out. And it was a bit embarrassing because it's not very good. It's not very refined. It's immediately they identified this as the beginning of a stone tool. And of course, if you have to prove that an object that's not yet been finally designed is on the way towards design, this is an even more radical, this is even more evidence. So this is exactly the stone that was presented. And of course, the horrific thing was the moment they saw this, they rushed back to England and literally within 3 days went to the same place where John Frere had dug a hole in 1800. They dug another hole and found six of them. And then suddenly they discovered that they were everywhere, and suddenly they had all this kind of evidence, so then they rushed back to the Royal Society and make this presentation. So literally, after 56 years, suddenly all the same evidence is reversing, and reversing very, very powerfully on the basis of this particular object. In other words, the sense of time was permanently revolutioned with an ever-expanding field of prehistory. So the human suddenly had this prehistory which was growing and growing, and this prehistory was unleashed as a form of kind of permanent self-reflection on the species, on the human species, through a restless kind of debate about the meaning of these kind of techno-fossils. The apparent presence of design was treated as the oldest evidence of the human, but you could say design for what exactly? Because the main point is almost all of these objects, as I said before, came out of the ground looking like they had never been used, and they were typically in piles. If you found one, you would find 10, 20, or 30. Darwin, as I said before, was super skeptical that this would be what humans would spend all their time doing, but then he was persuaded by his best friend, a geologist, that in fact the evidence was very, very strong. And then he added a passage to the 1861 American translation of The Origin of the Species to discuss these objects. In the end, by the way, these objects are not very good. They're hard to hold. They're not very good for killing animals. By the way, a symmetrical stone is more difficult to hold in your hand and more difficult to kill with. So there, if it is a tool, and if it's designed for killing, it's not very, very good. In the end, it seems more likely that the design of the earliest tools was more about their ornamental beauty rather than their defined function. Visually striking designs were used to attract the survival of the craftsperson's genes by attracting mates. In other words, if I can use a stone to kill an animal, that's great. I'm going to live for the next week. But if nobody will have sex with me, I'm finished. Right? So if you can say, hey, take a look at my hand axe, then you're sort of saying, you know, what kind of brain, what kind of body, what kind of guy am I? Have sex with me. So in other words, these objects are produced to look beautiful, to look like tools that look beautiful. And it's, of course, it's very important to remember that half of Darwin's book was devoted to sexual selection. Just to give an example, it's a stupid idea for humans to have no fur. It's not good in winter and it's not good in summer. But he said somewhere along the line, humans decided that was sexy and we selected for that. We designed nudity as something very attractive. So at a certain point, he makes this very strong argument that like the peacock and like all the other forms of ornament in nature, there is this very, very important form of design, sexual design, and it would seem that actually the tools are exactly in that order. So if you follow that argument, in the end, the earliest tools are really about their beauty. They are exactly like the coloured feathers of a peacock and all the other seemingly unnecessary structures, colours and patterns in the natural world. More than half of the book, as I say, is about this particular phenomenon, and he writes extensively about the ways that humans attach artificial ornaments to their body and actively reshape every part of their bodies. The point is, all these modes of self-refashioning actually bind humans closer to nature. The more we redesign our body, the more, as it were, natural we are, rather than separating us from this. This, of course, permanently complicates the archaeologist's foundational gesture of using design as the evidence of human thought and life. The most carefully and repeatedly made tools are not necessarily made to be used. The exhibition of design itself might be their primary goal. In other words, these were designed to look like they had been designed. I mean, you know, for example, if you buy an Aldo Rossi coffee pot, which I did once, it's beautiful. But you get burnt because he never did. The handle is exactly made of this continuous with the metal of the coffee pot. So it looks incredibly elegant. And all of those who feel more elegant because we have an Aldo Rossi coffee pot also have a scar where we hold that coffee pot. In other words, something that looks so beautiful to use is actually not so beautiful in the end. Okay, so where is this headed? Well, the amazing thing is that the reverse is true. Something that looks like it's made only for ornament, and these are the oldest ornaments that have been found. They are hand-painted marine shells that would be hung around the neck as a form of decoration. These have a very specific purpose. By the way, paleoanthropologists and archaeologists argue about anything. They just argue all the time except for one thing. If you find ornament, then you've found a kind of social contract and you've found media. This is regarded by archaeologists as a media. What kind of media? If I wear a group of shells like this, it's of no use to the people that already know me, and it's of no use to people that live too far away to ever possibly know me, but it's quite useful in communicating with the people that live on the other side of the next hill who are similar enough to me that they might be able to represent the code. In other words, this is a medium of communication aimed at the so-called middle distance. And if I can communicate with the people that live on the other side of the hill, then I can have sex with them. And if I can have sex with them, then I can actually spread my genes horizontally across the landscape. And, of course, that is the unique human capacity to pass knowledge and information, not only laterally, but also through time, through generations and so on. So this capacity, that those objects that we produce that look ornamental have a very specific technical function, and those objects that look like technically specific actually are ornamental in their function. This is what archaeologists would call information technology, a media of communication that broadcasts personal information to strangers that are close enough to understand the meaning of your ornaments, but not close enough to already know you personally, this middle distance. These shells are currently found in layers about 135,000 years old, but basically every year another 10,000 is added to that. Of course, the ornament is more fragile than the stone, so actually the evidence is smaller, but getting closer and closer. In other words, if we zoom back to the beginning of the human, the argument would be something like, there is nothing more human about the human than technology. Technology is the most human thing about us, and the most technological of all technologies is ornament. So actually, if you were to hypothetically look for the beginning of the human species, you wouldn't look for a stone axe, you would look for something painted. This means that the evolution of the human was never simply about the ability to make tools as such. Again, just to take a 3.3 million-year-old tool, understood to be a tool, these have been found long before the evolution of the so-called human species. In other words, the ability to make such tools long precedes the arrival of the human. Even the hand axe associated with Homo erectus, with its consistent teardrop shape, is, in comparison to the earlier shapes, the random shapes of earlier tools, is in the hands of other species before us. So this is not at all uniquely human. 'Tis the ornamental systems that mark the emergence of the human. Precisely the symmetry of the stone, which required an enormous amount of work. Just to show you, the one on the left is 1.4 million years old, and the one on the right is 300,000 years old. So we spent 1.1 million years developing nothing. Right? Again, so it's not just you say, hey, look how beautiful is my axe. It's like, hey, look at my axe. It's exactly the same as every other axe we've made for 1 million years. Please have sex with me. Right? This sort of, and you know, that may be actually, you know, more sophisticated than lines that some of you have heard in this room, or it may be just the repetition of that. Of course, it's just very, very tempting and almost essential to make to sort of jump from the cell phone. I mean, this warrior is checking the price of crops to see whether or not he should take them to market on this day. This particular use of that tool, of the cell phone, is in exactly the same area where these first tools have been located. And it would be so foolish of us to think of somehow technology as something that is belonging to the rich and to the north. And exactly one's argument has to go to Africa. But just to sort of summarize, the ability to go beyond what is needed is the uniquely human trait. It's actually the capacity to produce useless things. We are the species, the only species, that produces things that don't work. Right? Everybody else, a bird figures out a certain kind of stick can get a worm out of a tree, they will do that for the next 1.5 million years. 24 hours later, we're thinking, what if I shook the tree? What if I started to sing to the tree? Humans have an extraordinary capacity to produce things that don't work. We produce so many things that don't work that every now and then some of them do work, and then we pretend that we've designed them. And in fact, design might be a word for retroactively claiming that we understand that we have kind of, as it were, produced an object. But in reality, most of the time, we are mystified by the objects that we have produced, and just as much have been produced by them. The ability to go beyond what's needed to make something useless or something different is absolutely crucial. The making of useless things or things whose use has yet to be discovered makes all the difference. And yet, for that very reason, nothing in the fossil record, no artifact or no object of contemporary life today can be divided between useless and useful tool and ornament. We never know which way function is going to go. We never know which way the human is going to go. More often than not, what is seen as an ornament is actually doing the real work, and what looks like a tool is really for show. And it is, as it were, the vibration between them that is the most uniquely human thing. So basically, to summarize, all I'm saying is, and this was the position we were taking in this exhibition, that if you go back to the beginning of design, as it were, Design is not a word about what we do to the future. We don't, as it were, move forward. Design is a retroactive label to claim certain strange relationships that we have with objects in the moment where we feel we can move beyond the strangeness of that relationship to something else. In other words, we are that horrible experience of seeing myself in the mirror or whatever that is that I see or are seen by, that strange relationship, which is the same strange relationship we have with every object we produce, did I produce this or I didn't, we punctuate that strangeness with the word design as a kind of retroactive claim which we then multiply and reproduce and can do so for millions of years if necessary. And it's in that spirit that the beginning of design is the beginning of a radical questioning of the status of the human. Design is precisely not, getting back to Bashir's point, not answering a question, but asking a question even more radical, a question that defies answer. Anyway, that was like the beginning of the story. And the end of the Bible is coming from Beatrice.
Okay. So let's jump to another section of the book, which is actually, as I was saying, right in the middle of the 20th century and has asked the question that design is an anesthetic. And to demonstrate this, I'm going to read part of this chapter that has to do with Adolf Loos. Adolf Loos is very well known in the architecture world, of course, and I suppose is also known to you. But what is interesting to us in this regard is that the elimination of ornament, the famous elimination of ornament that Adolf Loos advocated, and here is Adolf Loos. It's not simply, as you will see, an aesthetic choice, as is always presented, but a neurological and even a narcotic one. Loos argues that we no longer have the nerves to eat, dress, and decorate as in previous century. And here you have him giving a series of lectures in the Sorbonne, precisely in 1926, the man with the modern nerves. So modern man, he argues, has a whole new set of nerves with completely different sensitivities. In Ornament and Crime, his famous essay, he actually speaks of his horror in front of all these decorated animals in culinary displays, particularly if he thinks he has to eat one of these stuffed animal corpses. I only eat roast beef, he says, right? Or roast beef, of course, being the abstraction of meat. He's completely repulsed by this banquets of another period. He feels the same nausea in the face of excessive ornament, whether on food or on architecture, and he writes, "We lack the steady nerves to drink from an elephant's ivory tusk on which an Amazon battle scene has been engraved." The rejection of ornament, then, is a physiological reaction. It's not that he doesn't like ornament. It's that he doesn't have the nerve. He feels nausea in front of this ornament. By 1921, he argues that the whole biology of man had evolved to give modern man a whole new set of nerves. I wanted to put this painting of Kokoschka to see that actually Loos was a very nervous man, as you can see, with his hands and everything. In Ornament and Education in 1924, he wrote, "Modern man, the man endowed with a modern nervous system, does not need ornament. On the contrary, he loathes it. Every object that we call modern lacks ornament." In Karl Kraus, and here you have Karl Kraus, who is a very close friend of Adolf Loos and a well-known writer, and I like also to put these paintings of Kokoschka again, because the hands and the nervousness of these individuals at the turn of the century. And here is Karl Kraus with his dear Fackel. Well, in Karl Kraus, Walter Benjamin quotes an author called Robert Schoe. And by the way, Robert Schoe is interesting for architecture because he is the brother of Gustav Schoe, from whom Adolf Loos built a controversial house in Vienna in 1922. But returning to Karl Kraus, Kraus writes, Robert Shaw, "discovered a great subject that had never before set in motion the pen of a journalist, the rise of the nerves." This is Benjamin talking about Kraus he's discovered this new subject, which is the rights of the nerves. He became the advocate of the nerves, but the subject grew under his hand to become the problem of private life, end of the quote. So private life, the interior, becomes newly fragile, like that of the nervous individual analyzed by psychoanalysis, or the vulnerable body of the tuberculosis patient penetrated by the X-ray. Everybody becomes a child, like a child or a patient needing to be brought up in soft lining. It is as if the, like it is a patient in a sanatorium near Davos being subjected to hydrotherapy and being all brought up in this white linen. It is as if the nerves are so new that the modern individual has only just been born and needs a protective incubator to survive, to gain the necessary strength. Law's architecture, you can argue, is such an incubator. But Law himself was very fragile. He suffered numerous nervous and physical ailments throughout his life, and at the end he checked himself into a sanatorium run by his friend, the psychiatrist Dr. Schwarzman in Karlsruhe, where he died in 1933. A year later, Buckminster Fuller had included nerve shock proofing. I mean, you have to care about earthquake proofing or maybe flood proofing, but nerve shock proofing as one on his list of the basic requirements for any for a house. Frederick Kiesle, again, also a super nervous individual, here totally protected by his endless house. He's always cocooning himself. And Richard Neutra all will develop entire theories of design based precisely on the nerves. It is as if the nerves themselves were the true clients of modern architecture. And you know, here you have, of course, Neutra. All these Viennese, right? Kiesler is Viennese, Loos is Viennese. So I thought maybe it's a Viennese thing, right? But it's not just them, because if you think about this Purkersdorf sanatorium outside Vienna that was designed by Joseph Hoffmann at the turn of the century in 904, I mean, they used to all check themselves in, you know, all the intelligentsia of the time, Gustav Mahler, Arnold Schoenberg, even Hugo von Hofmannsthal, even the architect himself, who had, by the way, had suffered a nervous breakdown before he was commissioned to do the Purkersdorf. And according to his biographer, Seckler, this is the reason why he took the commission. He also checked himself in regularly, as does Coloman Moser, who designed the furniture in the sanatorium. And I'm not sure what he's suffering from, but in this picture you can see something is going on, right? And this is the beautiful furniture of the Purkersdorf, and this white and incredibly clean spaces for that time, really shocking, which are supposed to have been to have had such an effect already, a placebo effect, that patients talk about the calming effect of this white, clean architecture that calms the nerves, precisely the nerves of the metropolitan individual that is extremely nervous, obviously. Well, Camillo Sitte, again, a very important author in architecture, who wrote this incredibly important book in architecture and urban planning about the design of the cities. He himself clearly suffered from agoraphobia. He describes in great detail his fear of crossing these long avenues. And you have the sense that really he himself is suffering from this agoraphobia, and he starts arguing that one should design the city like a medieval place with public spaces more like interiors in which the individual is protected, because, you know, we have this new fear, he says, of crossing the street. And, of course, agoraphobia had been recently kind of identified as a disorder. And it's very interesting, because agoraphobia is always is a women's thing. But I think this guy... he was agoraphobic. He describes in too much detail. But it's not just a Viennese thing. Here is Serber with his famous glass architecture. And he writes, sanatoria will also want glass buildings. The influence of splendid glass architecture on the nerves is indisputable. Right? No, nothing is indisputable, but let alone, you know. So he himself, by the way, Serber, you know, starved himself to death after World War I. He was also a super nervous individual. As a consequence of the trauma of World War I, he basically also went into some kind of nervous eating disorder and ended up dying precisely of this. Well, it's not that after the war, the nerves continue to be the true clients of modern architecture. After the war, this is a cover of Architectural Review, but most significant, perhaps, Arts and Architecture, the magazine where Charles and Ray Eames were published, not only have these incredible covers and these kinds of images, but Charles and Ray Eames in particular define design itself, and this is an incredible definition of what design is, as a shock absorber. Okay, I'm sure you have used many definitions of design, but that's a new one, right? They had been involved during the war in the military production of these splints, kind of literally shock absorbers for a traumatized body. That's probably the most important thing the Eames did at the end of the war. They ended up with this big medal for all the lives that they have saved through these plywood splints, and then with all the same machinery that they have and the funding they have received for the military for the development of this splint, then you have the potato chip chair. So the plywood furniture comes right out of this trauma. But more interesting to me is the fact that at a certain point they do this house and the Eames house, and they say about the house in general, the house must make no insistent demands for itself, but rather aid as background for life in work and as a reorientator and a shock absorber. So now this is a new definition of what a house is, a house, and you have heard many definitions of what a house is, protection from the elements, I don't know, whatever. But reorientator and shock absorber, right? So you may want to then think about what is this shock and who is disoriented. And of course, the question is that domestic life could no longer be taken for granted in the post-war years, post-World War II. This is an American family in their bomb shelter, which they were all encouraged to build. So domestic life could no longer be taken for granted. It became an art form, carefully constructed and marketed by a whole new industry, a form of art therapy for a traumatized nation, a reassuring image of the good life that could be bought like any other product. So instead of offering a complete environment to the post-war consumer, the Eames offered a variety of components with which individuals could construct and rearrange themselves. So, of course, then the shock of the post-war years is the shock of nuclear annihilation. Good design offers good life, a galaxy of happy, self-contained objects for people who do not feel safely contained and cannot be sure of life itself. The Eames, by the way, perfected the keep smiling strategy. Perhaps no other designers can be seen smiling so often and so polemically. Every time they invent something new or they design something new, they are like in an advertisement or a Hollywood movie, smiling and presenting always their new, the first version of their house there in the model, both so happy, so close to the object that if it was a new born baby. And this is particularly shocking when you compare it with the previous generation of designers who never ever, like Loos or Le Corbusier, who would never be caught in a photograph smiling under any circumstances, right? Okay, so if this is what Loos thought about ornament, that it was an anesthetic, let me go now to Le Corbusier. Because also here is his L'Esprit Nouveau magazine, and this is the equipment of a dentist that he published in L'Esprit Nouveau magazine. He must have taken the photographs from somewhere, admires these white, smooth walls. And then he writes this incredible thing. He says that that these smooth surfaces are an anesthetic. An anesthetic for what? He writes, an anesthetic to the nerves shattered in the aftermath of war. Yeah. And this is at the same time, of course, that he says himself, that actual anesthetics, cocaine, were being peddled in the streets of Paris. Cocaine, of course, was one of the first substances used as an anesthetic for surgery on the recommendation of Freud. The history of modern anesthetics in many ways uncannily parallels that of modern architecture and design. The first public demonstration of an operation under anesthesia took place in the Massachusetts General Hospital in 1846. Anesthesia, of course, is the removal of feelings, the temporal suppression of the central nervous system in order to achieve lack of sensation. Aesthetics from the Greek had everything to do with sensation, with the perception by bodily feeling, and nothing to do with what we think of aesthetics today, that is, with the intellect or with the ideal, which is all 19th century ideas. So in that sense, the modern idea of aesthetics as a branch of philosophy is contemporary with the age of industrialization and with the age of the anesthesia. So aesthetics in the modern sense of the word is therefore already an anesthetic. An anesthetic in the sense of anesthesia. It has removed all bodily sensations or feelings. The shock of the war, of course, the shock of the machine, the shock of the metropolis, have in common anesthesia, the temporary removal of feeling, whether physical or psychological. In this beautiful essay of Walter Benjamin, Experience and Poverty, Walter Benjamin wrote about people returning from World War I, poorer in experience, unable to communicate, silent, in shock, after feeling the full force of modern technology. A generation, he writes, that had gone to school in horse-drawn streetcars now stood in the open air amid a landscape in which nothing was the same except the clouds, and at the center, in a force field of destructive torrents and explosions, the tiny, fragile human body, end of the quote. Feeling was no longer possible. Humans were anesthetized. This poverty of experience finds its parallel in modern architecture, in glass and steel buildings. This, of course, World War II, but this speaks about also this anesthesia, no? These people that continue to go to the Holland House Library after it has been destroyed by an air raid in London in 1940, as if nothing has happened, no? Carry on. This poverty of experience, according to Benjamin, finds its parallel in modern architecture, in glass and steel buildings, on whose smooth surfaces the inhabitants cannot leave any traces, any memories. In his writings on Baudelaire, Benjamin speaks of the passerby, of the smile of the passerby in the metropolis, keep smiling, that protects them from an unprecedented numbers of encounters with strangers by developing this mimetic tactics. So the smile then, according to Benjamin, already in the metropolis, is functioning as a mimetic shock absorber. Modern design, you can argue, is likewise a shock absorber, its frozen smile barely hiding the terror it tries to cover over. And with this, I'll go very quickly to another part of the book that has to do with the design of health, which is very much related to this question. And the point here is that design is medicine. So if classical theories of the Greek polis already follow theories of the four humors, contemporary ideas of health are organizing design theories today. This is the basically, the, in a nutshell, what we are trying to demonstrate here. Vitruvius already in the first century BC launched Western architectural theory by insisting that all architects need to study medicine. Okay, for the architects in the room, you didn't have enough studying architecture, you now have to study medicine as well, right? He devoted a large part of the first of his 10 books on architecture to the question of health. So architecture itself, for Vitruvius, is a branch of medicine. As here you have one of the editions of Cesarino of Vitruvius. As Renaissance schools of medicine start using casts of body parts, design school, such as the Accademia del Diseño in Florence of 1563, also used casts of fragments of historical buildings for teaching, and anatomical dissection was a central part of the training. Actually, this tradition of doing casts of buildings continue for centuries. This is actually MIT, the first school of architecture in the United States. But this is the interesting thing, I think, that in the Renaissance, anatomical dissection was required of all students of architecture and design that have to go to the local hospital and spend days on end drawing the cadaver as the cadaver was putrefying. Of course, there was no way to preserve it, even as there were reports of people getting sick, of students getting sick. You still have to be there working in the hospital. As doctors, in the sketchbooks of Leonardo da Vinci, these cutaway views of architecture and interiors appear many times besides anatomical drawings. He understood the interior of the brain and of the womb in architectural terms as enclosures that needed to be cut through precisely to reveal their secrets. So the central reference for architecture was no longer a whole body, the famous body of Leonardo, but it's a dissected, analyzed body, fragmented and analyzed body. Likewise, this one explains by itself, architecture and the body and dissection. If you move to the mid-19th century, Viollet-le-Duc, he illustrated his Dictionary Raisonné with perspectival cutaway views, so in medieval buildings as if it had been dissected. He had been very influenced by Georges Cuvier, Lessons of Compare Anatomy. So again, another architect very much influenced by an anatomist. As medical representations changed, so did architectural representations, and in the 20th century, the widespread use of the X-rays made a new way of thinking about architecture possible. Modern buildings even started to look like medical images with transparent glass walls revealing the inner secrets of the building. Indeed, the architecture of the early 20th century cannot be understood outside tuberculosis. I mean, it's a very little known fact that not only these buildings start to look like X-rays, but these architects were themselves fascinated with X-rays, mist-collected X-ray. You can find this in his publications. Sometimes he publishes X-rays. And of course, he starts designing the building itself as if it was an X-ray. Okay, so how are we doing in terms of time? Let me see. Oh, wait. The symptoms, if not the principles of modern architecture, seem to be taken straight out of a medical test on the disease before Robert Koch discovered the tuberculosis bacillus in 1882. A standard medical book, and here are his tests and the bacillus. A standard medical book gave as cause of tuberculosis lack of exercise, sedentary indoor life, defective ventilation, deficiency of light, and depressive emotion. It took a very long time for these notions to lose credibility. Tuberculosis was thought to be a wet disease produced by damp cities, and somehow this is Le Corbusier, for example, who argues that historic Paris is tubercular Paris. This is in a book of Le Corbusier, and of course he argues that modern architecture has to be detached from the ground that is wet and where disease breeds. So modern architects precisely provided such a change of environment. 19th century architecture was crossed out, was demonized as unhealthy, and sunlight, ventilation, exercise, roof garden, hygiene, and whiteness were offered as a means to prevent, if not to cure, tuberculosis. And all of a sudden, you have all these images of modern architecture, which has all to do with exercise, with whiteness, with health, with fresh air, etc. Even the architect has to give example, Richard Duker, throwing himself into a pond, not exactly, you know, the heroic image of the architect in front of a building that we were used to before. So they all have to give example. Yes, I'm trying to go faster so that we can have a conversation. So maybe I go faster here, but it's interesting to know that Le Corbusier himself had been very obsessed with his own health. Arriving in Paris, he felt always very tired until he met this Dr. Winter that told him that he shouldn't be resting, that was a 19th century idea, that what you should do is actually do sports. And he became a sports man. In his film, La Architecture d'aujourd'hui, of 1929, Le Corbusier argues, that the sea breeds in the city because in the 20th century, people still live as in the Middle Ages. And he explicitly equates this disease with the old city and argues that one has to cut through this fabric of the city to eliminate all this illness and offers instead you should instead sunbathe in the terrace and exercise also in the terrace. So you have all these images of people of children and women in taking the sun. Nobody seems to know anything about skin cancer, but the obsession with tuberculosis is really there, even in the illustrations that that Le Corbusier uses, using lungs, etc., that are all taken from medical books. So he's completely obsessed with this question. So the house itself is first and foremost a machine for health, a form of therapy. As I said, Le Corbusier himself had been obsessed with his health until he met this Dr. Winter, which turned out to be a fascist, but in the meantime, he got Le Corbusier into boxing, into swimming, into playing basketball with him. Every there he is with Pierre Jeanneret, actually boxing on the beach, so he became an athlete. But this Dr. Winter turned out to be, as I say, as a fascist. In an article that he writes, I read, only a strong program of urbanism, the program of a fascist government, is capable of adapting the modern city to the needs of all. And in that article, he's writing actually about the architecture and urban planning of Le Corbusier. And of course, there's all these other images of exercise and dance, Dalcross, in L'Esprit Nouveau. Okay, so very much towards the end. Every age, you can say, has its own afflictions, as Han writes in the Burnout Society. And we can add that each affliction has its architecture. In that sense, the age of bacterial diseases, particularly tuberculosis, as we have seen, gave birth to modern architecture, to white buildings detached from the humid ground where disease breeds. As Le Corbusier put it. The discovery of, and those are all images that you know, of Paimio, etc., the sun, the heliotherapy in countries where the sun was not, like around here, that is not so frequent. All these children in school, again, were subjected to constant sun and heliotherapy. Nobody seemed to have known anything about the danger, actually, of skin cancer. So every age has its own affliction. The discovery of antibiotics, and particularly of streptomycin in 1943, put an end to that age. The post-war years, attention shifted to psychological problems. And this is the interesting thing. The same architects that had been arguing for a long time that their architecture was always about combating tuberculosis, preventing tuberculosis, like Richard Neutra, all of a sudden say that the architect is actually a shrink. The house is not just a medical device for the prevention of tuberculosis, but for providing psychological comfort, what Neutra called nervous health. So here we are with the nerves again. The 21st, a very interesting thing with him was Wilhelm Reich and the organ machine that, believe it or not, in all the houses of Neutra, there was an organ machine that was supposed to not cure you of every possible disease, but also gives you a lot of sex energy. And not only that, he goes from arguing that these organ machines have to be in each one of his houses, the many clients of Neutra had orgone machines, but also he ends up arguing that the house itself that he designed has this capacity, right? So architecture itself has the capacity to enhance not only your health, but also your sexuality. So if the 20th century had all these discussions, the 21st century is, according to Hahn, the age of the neurological disorders, depression, ADHD, borderline personality disorders, and what is called burnout syndrome. And then we may want to ask, what is the architecture of these afflictions? The 21st century, you can also say, is the age of allergies, the age of the environmentally hypersensitive, unable to live in the modern world. Never at any one time in history had been so many people that are allergic to chemicals, to buildings, to electromagnetic fields, to fragrances, etc. Since the environment is now almost completely man-made, we have become allergic to ourselves, to our own hyper-extended body in a kind of autoimmune disorders. They are actually communities of the afflicted, living in a kind of replay of the 1960s, in bubbles, tents, and all cars that have been cleaned of all toxic materials, usually in the desert or far away from civilization. Nomads moving at the very sniff of a chemical coming from the shifting wind that brings whiffs of industry, detergent, fabric softener, fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides, exhaust from cars, etc., as Dolly Bellamy puts it in When the Sick Rule the World. They are the dropouts of our age. On the other side of the spectrum, there is the burnout society that Hahn writes about it. Those who, in working for themselves, push themselves harder than anybody could have ever pushed them, the achievement subject, who turns out to be much more disciplined than the obedient subject, despite the fact that he obeys only himself or herself. Master and slave conflated. No one can be so brutal with anybody as one can be with oneself. Pushing the limits of the imaginable. This creature does not experience it as pain or as an obligation, but as self-realization. The environmental hypersensitive are not mentioned by Hahn, perhaps because he considers them, as many in the medical establishments do, as afflicted by neurological disorders, depressed, hypochondriac, etc. These seemingly opposite symptoms might be two sides of the same coin of the illnesses of our time. But implied in all of this is a different city and new questions for design, or very ancient questions about the limits of the body and mind and how to take shelter in a threatening world. So with this, I finish. Thank you.
And I wonder, what kind of questions do you see that design should address in the future in order to be more proactive?
I can't see the future. I mean, the future is precisely called the future because it comes as a total shock. So in a way, design and the future are in a very odd relationship. So the future is that which you could not imagine, and design is some kind of imagination. But I think if you follow the kind of logic that Beatrice and I were suggesting, if design is a way of asking questions, then this is the role of the designer. And it's not about creating a heroic new world. I mean, it's very difficult to imagine any one designer having any huge impact on society and on the economy and on the planet. But the capacity to ask a question is so precious and potentially so contagious that if we position the designer as somebody who asks questions, then there really is this. And I must say that those of us who teach in design schools, what is astonishing is in architecture schools is the optimism. I mean, if you read what used to be called the newspaper, there's no reason to be optimistic about anything, especially in the United States right now. And yet, every architect and every designer has in common this unbelievable and super irrational thought that even very small changes to the built environment produce a possibility of a better society. That if I change the way you see the world, then maybe you think differently, and if you think differently, maybe you dream differently. If you dream differently, maybe eventually we all live differently. So what's astonishing about schools of design, schools of art, schools of architecture, but probably schools of design and architecture more than art schools, is this unbelievable optimism. So I would say there are these two thoughts. One is this makes no sense to think that you're going to redesign the world. Actually, other people are doing that. In today's world, you can design your children. So in a moment in time where you can design your children and the weather, what does it mean to design a coffee pot? Not very much. But if you would ask questions with your work, then you have something very, very amazing to offer. And just to finish, artists who traditionally ask questions, it's not so clear that they're asking questions anymore, because art is now very, very securely positioned within the contemporary kind of neoliberal economy. We pretty much know what an artist is, what they look like, what their work operates like, what it should sell for. We don't know what design is right now. And so I actually think this means that the role of the designer is much more like the role of the artist in the past, which is why if you go into a design school, it feels a lot like an art school. And if you go into an art school, it feels like an advertising company. Just to exaggerate a little.
Thank you so much both for the fantastic presentation. The presentation it has a lot. The book is really dense, and it goes into kind of cake bits of information. And when I was reading it, I came to think of my colleague here at Konstfack, and I had to wear this today because I think that your book is as much as I hate this field as much as you love it. And I'm interested in, like, what did you make choose the entry points that you did? Like, what did you leave out?
What do you think?
I'm not so sure. I mean, it seems like every single thought we had during the preparation of this, so it became like a diary of the things we were thinking about. Were presenting this question. Where for a year we were preparing for the Biennale. First, we had to go to Istanbul and at some point and present the topic of Are We Human? So all the thoughts that went into this Biennale, it became a little bit of a diary. And of course, you are always the same person, so many of our previous preoccupations are also there, but are finding a different form in this particular moment and for this particular occasion. It's interesting that we were doing this in Istanbul during a very, very difficult time, but I mean, when we were preparing this is when there was the coup in Turkey, in Istanbul. Then when there was the terrorist attack in the airport, then when there were all these things, all of this was happening during that year in which we were preparing the Biennale, and in many ways, people in Turkey responded to the question, are we human, with exactly, yeah, are we human? And when the question presented itself of whether we should keep going or withdraw, and then it was very interesting because our Western friends were saying, oh, you should withdraw, make a statement by withdrawing from the Biennale of Istanbul, and people in Istanbul were saying to us, absolutely, or in Turkey in general, absolutely not. I mean, this will be giving in the only space in which we have for debate, for discussion. So in the end, we sided with the people from the region that thought that it was very important to keep open this platform for discussion, precisely in this very difficult and dangerous time for all of us. Mm. And
I love your
description of it as a diary, but it would be sort of the diary of two patients. We could be in, you know, like, so it was not much editing. I think it's a good, the question is very interesting because I think we were not editing so much. Was the idea of a little Japanese book, the kind of book you read in a subway, that you could take any one piece of it? And the funny thing was, when they translated it into Japanese, the Japanese made it bigger. But I think therapy, not just like personally, but I think that there are thousands of books written about design, and they're really stupid. I mean, they're massively stupid. This idea of good design has gone viral. Politicians, right wing or left wing, think of themselves as good designers. Good design is not good. And so, in a way, the book is an attack, a pretty direct assault on the idea of good design. And we try to do a history to show that good design comes out of arguments in the 1830s in England. It's very much an English idea that eventually migrates to the Bauhaus and then to the world. And I think there's a need for teachers, and we are teachers, to rethink design, because precisely design, this idea that we had a long time ago and was really a radical idea, needs to be rebooted. So I think in that spirit, the idea of this book is not that it tells you how to redesign, but it's an attempt to reduce the amount of stupidity. And it's just mountains of it, stockpiles of stupidity. It's like we could sell the stupidity about design, human-centered design. What a nightmare, if you think about it.
Yes, and you know what I mean? Books and what you're talking about are creating norms, are creating, like, that someone is telling us how to behave or to how to think and so on. And I think it's for me, at least, it feels like a decision that you have been, like, looking or, like, talking about the Western world. And I wonder how you've been thinking about, like, taking the decision of not including which part you wanted to talk about when it came to the design field.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
And did you take a decision there? I'm going to let everyone in super soon. I just need
but of course your questions, your questions imply that we designed the book.
No. It's like that. But
yeah,
when
like
we produce
we
something, when we put something into society, we are kind of telling our own story, and we're taking decisions. And the other books that you're talking about are actually creating norms, if they are.
Yeah. I think that's right. I give you an example that I don't know if it helps, but you know, when you make a drawing, I mean, if you knew what you were going to draw, you wouldn't have to draw it, right? If you had already in your mind perfectly the drawing, you don't need to draw it. So you draw because you don't know what you're going to draw. And obviously, as the drawing appears, you change your decision about what the drawing might be. So anybody who draws knows that the drawing is not really happening in your head or in your hand or on the page, but in some very complicated transaction. In some ways, when you draw, you are quite obviously being drawn by the drawing. And you may recognize in the drawing something beautiful or ugly that you didn't intend, and then you might try to reinforce that. This is all we're saying about the relationship between the human and objects. We have these things, as it were, at the end of our hands, and we don't know how we produced them or what we made. So design itself is about the confusion we feel in the space of objects that we may or may not have produced. We don't know. The same thing was happening to us with the book, is what I'm trying to say. We tried very much to draw design, like to try to, because we are historians, to try to give a history of design, and we didn't know beforehand. We just are drawing, but maybe it's a little bit answering the question that Africa and what the British would call the Middle East became the real reference points for all the arguments. So in a certain way, we did make a decision that partly was being in Istanbul, where if you dig a hole, you find another civilization. It's just, in a way, stupid to listen to the West after being there. You know, it's just a different. So it's a different mindset. But having said that, we are very much creatures of the West, mystified still by design. It's a little bit why the project keeps going. We don't know. We have many, many friends now that we have tricked into. Maybe we are tricking you now because you should have gone. Maybe we are trying to trick you into opening up design again, because in the 1830s and so on, it was really opened up, and we think it needs to be opened up, and the best ideas could come from the youngest, probably comes from the youngest person in the room.
It's not working. Oh, yes, it is. Please keep it here. And you too, Katya, because otherwise.
Hi. I have a. I wonder. Well, all these. When you talked about this, like how we blur the lines between organisms and machines, and also like how we design. How design materializes, what the designers tries to present as neutral, and when we now are able to like redesign our bodies, what do you think about like? Do you think that we will be able to leave the obsession of how we polarize our bodies in gender.
And what would your answer be? What do you think? Yeah.
Hello, hello, hello.
And maybe how radical the thought of how radical it would be to present that the body and the machine now isn't like it's the same thing. We have to see that it's the same thing and that we can't that the body and the gender was what we had to use to continue to live, but no, it's not. Maybe. Yeah. What do you think? What do you think about that?
I mean, I'm curious, more curious about what you think. But I say a couple of things, and Beatrice will be much more intelligent. So I just create some noise while she's thinking, just to explain how this relationship works. Yeah, I think the argument would go something like that the confusion of the body and technology is not at all new. It's the beginning of our species. This is what our species is. It's this kind of confusion, which means that technology is organic, living, fragile, constructed, and also that the human body is machine-like and so on. So if over a very long time we have these very, very fixed gender identities, which are not at all in any way natural to the body or technology, but are highly constructed, maintained, and just unbelievable amounts of violence associated with this design. If there's been this design, hey, male, female, sort of thing, all of that attempt to make that design for so many years and to claim that that was neutral, in other words, that was not a decision, that there are just men, that it's not a design thing, but it's kind of like a back of nature, cosmic, aren't they, whatever. All of that went against everybody's lived experience, all those millions of years, on which, you know, this seemed to me there is no one ever that ever felt naturally belonging to that. So it is at some level true that the fact that we can now technologically redesign the body in an almost unlimited way immediately destabilizes this gender distinction, or to say it another way around, exposes it to be a design, then opens up a debate about what's going to happen to that. So I think does this mean political liberation, et cetera? This is where I'm uncertain, because it seems to me, let's say, according to what we're saying, is there was never anything other than a kind of trans reality that was disguised by seemingly neutral codings, binary codings. And this is where I think it links to what Beatrice is saying, is because this supposed neutrality of good design is actually incredibly brutal. I mean, this is probably a terribly bad example, especially in terms of gender and so on, but your cell phone does everything it can to reassure you that everything's okay. You stroke your cell phone with the love and tender touch that you would normally give to a lover or a newborn child, but actually probably to the lover, and even the child is more like that. But the phone, you know, and actually this object, this cell phone, doesn't tell you anything about itself. So its neutrality, its smoothness, is what Matisse was calling an anesthetic effect. So one could say that and this is just a horrible argument, but I sort of believe it, that the binary gender coding was itself some kind of anesthetic device, which has a double effect. One, to hide the lives that everybody is living, but also to do extraordinary levels of violence, structural violence, on a kind of daily basis. So designers could enter into a discussion about a new kind of politics of the body coming, as it were, from design. But I would be inclined to say, yep, it was never anything other than, you know, the most ordinary understanding of the human body is the strangest thing there is. It is nothing but strangeness. So gender is just kind of criminal. Always has been. It's always understood to be. If you look at, and just, I mean, I could go for hours, as you can see. Architects would claim that they're not into politics, but gender is written into every architectural treatise from the beginning, very, very specifically. So gender is not something that people have; it's something that's designed, obviously. But you knew that's why you asked the question. Now something more thoughtful.
I think this is alive again.
I work in the biggest tech research institute in Sweden, so I'm surrounded by tech nerds who I think are designing our future. and often when we discuss...
Oh, God.
I am a little bit shocked by how they perceive things and their really mechanistic perception of the human. So then I wonder, once we live in this completely digitalized world where even the physical spaces can become obsolete, because, I mean, we don't know how it will look like, but I see more and more kids, as I have them, that they, you know, are so absorbed by the virtual realities that they could, if we would allow them, they would stay in them indefinitely almost. So then I'm wondering, what role will art and design have if we project ourselves into that future, where our day and the daily behavior is designed by the tech people who are providing all these solutions for our lives. And it is so natural to just follow them, because they're based on predictive analytics of our past behaviors and what we like. And we can see in these new services which are designed that just feed us with more and more of the same, which is based on our past behaviors. So, yeah, how do you see
the role of art and design in that future?
I guess I'm less pessimistic in the sense that I think it's true that we are already, all of us, living in this kind of hybrid space, but here we are in this, I mean, why did you come all the way to here, particularly all the, if you are in this university is one thing, but for other people it's a huge effort, right? So we continue to make this, despite the fact that lectures are close.
To your skin.
Okay, but yes, okay. Even if so many things are already online, even if lectures are sometimes streamed, even if they are recorded, etc., we still want to go somehow. So we are living both in a physical and in a hybrid space, physical and digital, and I think it's very important for architects and designers to think in those two realms. I think the necessity of people to still appear is very, very important. Think about the museum, for example. The museum has transformed enormously in recent years. When the Tate Modern expanded, I was asked to write about the catalog, and you know, it's the Herzog and de Meuron. I was looking at the building. I thought, yeah, well, okay, maybe I can understand how. But then I was so surprised. I mean, I thought they were expanding because they needed more galleries. They didn't need more galleries. All this new tower is mostly for people socializing. It's all about younger club of this and that. It's all these opportunities for selfie. So it's very much the museum in the age of social media, in an age in which more and more people are socializing not only with this with them, but also with others through Instagram or whatever. And architecture has become one of these the occasion in which people meet. So accomplished two different functions. The museum and so many institutions have been transformed, but design is not left behind. So I don't think that we are about to leave the physical world. I don't think that kids will do that either. They work with both, I think. But
yeah, I mean, it's because it's obviously the perfect book, so we can always say, you know, the last chapter is exactly on this question. But I wouldn't agree with you. I wouldn't use the word virtual. I mean, because almost that then makes it seem like an imaginary space that the children are going into, and precisely it's not an imaginary, and it's fully political and fully economic and fully physical. Just to argue, the single biggest object our species ever made is the global communications system. It's vast, it's unimaginably enormous, the biggest holes in the planet, the most heat, the most energy. It's barely visible. The only signs we have are sometimes you see cell phone towers on buildings, but we don't see all of the rest of the infrastructure. Every time you touch your phone and send a picture of the pasta before you eat it, because now, of course, you must send a picture of the pasta before you eat it, so that you are kind of eating it with your friends. Every time you do that, that picture is sent and your tweet is sent to all of the big server farms all over the world, because the way that logic works is nobody knows, not even the people who run those machines, what's relevant and what's not relevant. So your picture of the pasta has to go into the machine because maybe it gives a clue as to how to make more money. So it's an enormously physical system, not at all, let's say, virtual. And I think thinking of it as physical is one way it helps to start to hear what Batteries is saying about how these, they are more like layers that are overlapped. To say it another way around, architecture, which is our field, has never been other than a virtual reality system. It's a system of representation designed to, as it were, shift you out of your everyday world into a kind of university seems to me powerful virtual reality sort of machine. So the question is not virtual versus analog, but what you were saying about these feedback loops and these bubbles and these self-replicating systems. All the people who are producing that, and this was the beginning of your question, they are designers and they're using an idea about design that we invented. Right? How to do that. That's precisely why we're arguing we need to get out of that idea of design as providing solutions, as optimization. Basically, the idea of design as optimization and risk reduction, it's really killing us. It's what's getting these governments elected. Right? It's all about optimization. Right. So I know it seems stupid, but couldn't we at least consider what it means to talk to our students about not optimizing, not producing optimal solutions, not satisfying the client? You know, a really good architect, she doesn't give the client what the client asked for, but what the client wished that they had asked for, and later will pretend that they did. In fact, nobody likes an architect. Architects are only asked questions when you don't even know what the question is. If you know what the question is, then you get an engineer. You ask an architect when you are not sure. I think the ability to offer something that was not asked for seems to me something that we need to nurture in schools. And we don't, you know, we tend to say no. If you go from the school as a world of fantasy to the real world as a world of reality, you have to go from non-optimal dreams to sort of optimization. I think this is such a disastrous position.
Hello, good day. My name is Daniel from Iceland. And I just wanted to ask you, after a wonderful presentation, what would happen if you turn the electricity off everywhere?
I think this is a very, very interesting question. What will happen if we turn all our devices off? What will happen? I mean, there are spas now in places like California, where all these people that are high-tech, you know, the first thing that they have to do is to give up their cell phone and put it in a basket for a weekend or for an entire week, like detox centers, like Alcoholic Anonymous, but for technology. And I think it produces this incredible effect. People cry, but then when they have to give up their laptops and their cell phones and everything, but they go into this detox situation. With the electricity, I think there is some experiments also in places that, you know, you go and there is no. One has to think about this, about the ways, the multiple ways in which we are so overloaded with all kinds of information that our need to kind of as if it were detox is.
So I super disagree with you. And I was trying to think of a way of saying it without seeming obnoxious. I can't. Because, I mean, what you're saying, of course, firstly, we are electrical. We ourselves are electrical. So if you say, let's turn off all the electricity, what you're really saying is, let's amputate ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so you wouldn't be returning to be human anymore. What's really human is electricity. All of its horrors. I mean, what's horrible about all of these logarithms and all these optimizations and all these effects and all this attention? It's that it's us. It's the human part of us. So if we were to take away the electricity, it's not like some splendid, more emotional, more whatever creature would emerge. It would just simply be whatever happens after we amputate. It still could be. You still could be right. It could be that amputation is like the last thing to save ourselves. We need to amputate, but that would be a different idea. That would be saying we need to cut off the electricity because if we stay connected just another two generations, we don't survive. of course, it will be an interesting experiment because all of the people in the world right now who don't have electricity, which are billions, would have an enormous advantage. And so politically, it has really interesting consequences that the wisdom would be exactly inverse to the current use of energy. So I think that you could also make an argument that would be a very, very interesting experiment to do. I mean, it is amazing to watch what happens in a 4 or 5 hour, 24-year, 4 hour power cut in a city. But I would just...
In a situation in which all of a sudden there was no electricity, because we were, for example, with Sandy, the storm in New York, with the whole of Lower Manhattan went black. And you said, oh, okay, it's going to be a day, it's going to be a few hours. No, it was a whole week, right? And it became medieval. I mean, the whole of downtown Manhattan, it was very, very interesting because I never seen the city this way. I thought it was very tough because all of a sudden it was cold. It's not that there was no light, but there was not hot water and there was no heating and there was no anything. But what I remember most is this feeling that I was living in a city which I know so well, New York. I've been living there almost 40 years. And so all my life in New York, basically my adult life in New York, and another city emerged, another city in which restaurants, for example, that were, you know, they had food that was going to spoil anyway, start cooking in the street, but not with, of course, there's no gas, there's no electricity, they are making fires, I mean, they are feeding people that are passing around, all kinds of incredible situations, working in the streets with absolute darkness. The whole of Lower Manhattan was unbelievably dark, right? So that was,
so the answer is, I
will remember that for the rest of my life, I don't know you.
It's a very, it is a very apocalyptic description. You said it's almost like annihilating something. So I just wanted to kind of verify that in a way by asking the question. But again, it seems as if it just goes forward and forward. In the sort of state we're in now. Because we are becoming afraid of our offspring, the whole technological advancement, but at the same time, as you said, we are it and we are electrical. Mm-hmm. But we kind of must not destroy us, I think.
Beatrice was saying there is a kind of autoimmune disorder by which the species is now having an allergic reaction to itself. And of course, that's if the species is now bigger than the planet, now, and as Beatrice said, we are becoming more and more allergic to our environment. We are becoming allergic to ourselves. So this is your question goes to this kind of acupuncture point.
One of the symptoms of this is these detox centers that are emerging in many places, which I found them fascinating. The idea that you will go to a spa to kind of get rid of your addiction to technology.
I think we've been running out over time, and so is there?
Thank you for letting me in. I just wanted to connect to last Friday. For those of you who were here, we had a discussion on artificial intelligence and what that really is. And my question refers to what you're saying about not being able to predict the future. That is actually what the future is. But also to this image that you show. And the discussion we had last Friday was whether artificial intelligence was a way of reinventing God. Because if you look at religion, if we presume that man invented God in the first place because there was a need for it, and if we take one of the big religions as an example, for example, Christianity, it has been, even without advanced technology, very efficient in the way it's been spread, monetized, and how it has been both a means of control, of colonialism, of also have produced, economy, and so forth. But could we? Did you ever think about, you know, this kind of image and the technologies, the all the things that surrounds us and that also controls us in the same way? Have you ever been thinking about the comparison to a religious system, or even maybe we are reinventing God in this way, even without knowing it?
A last answer, Beatrice, Mark, both.
You're referring to this image in particular. This image is the image of a representation of all the stuff that we are, that is now in outer space. Incredible amount of junk, pieces of satellites, etc., that are in outer space to the point that is creating a problem also for all the space program. And the quote is from Gideon. It's nothing to do with what you see. The Gideon, of course, an architectural historian writing in the 40s, I suppose, at that or 50s at that time. It's part of a series of images with quotes from architectural historians and design historians that talk about that raise the question of the human. Like here, it's very interesting that Gideon, that had embraced modern technology and modern architecture, ask or states the question: it's time that we become, after World War II, that we become human again. And I think this is what refers. Maybe it's confusing to some.
Yeah. I mean, Gideon, especially, says Gideon was a big promoter of the kind of architecture of technology, but specifically the Holocaust. He changes his position and writes the book Mechanization Takes Command, which is sort of a self-critique, and he says we have lost ourselves. So this is. I mean, it relates very well to the question. I mean, we have a lot of opinions. Obviously, you can hear this. At the same time, we don't have any special grasp on the future or the truth, but what you said just sounds absolutely right. Yes, of course, God is designed; it's a kind of a design thing, and we are inventing new gods now. And I hesitate about the expression artificial intelligence because it implies that there was a non-artificial intelligence at some point, and. I mean, again, we are speaking in a kind of religious way. Like, I think I called the book a Bible. So if you go from the logic of the book, we don't have ideas individually or even socially. Ideas are born in interactions between humans and other species, humans and laboratories, technologies, protocols, contracts, systems, switches, filters, etc. So whatever intelligence would be, it is this. It's produced in these impossible to dimension sort of exchanges, which have a scale somewhat akin to the scale given to the gods. And it is interesting that in almost all religions, whatever god you have or set of gods, they at some point hang out with us. And there is this moment of exchange between the infinite transcendental time of the gods and the time that we live in. And I think that this, you know, there is this kind of call. There is a question of faith and also, in a certain sense, if the question is, are we human? It seems to me religion is one of the ways in which that question is answered. We a little bit arrogantly are arguing that design became a very dominant religion. It became a default way of understanding the world. So-called design thinking is understood to be a good thing. We're suggesting it can be a terrible thing. It can be a very efficient way to oppress people. It can optimize the uneven distribution of resources. So, you know, as a species, we have really perfected the ability of keeping people of a certain color, a certain race, a certain sexual identity disenfranchised. We are improving on that all the time using the logic of design. So I think I know we are heretics in design schools. We should be evicted.
Burnt.
I think we have to end now. I really want to thank you. I have millions of questions still, and I guess that we can keep with us, and all of us get the question: are we human when we leave? Thank you so much. Thank you.